Expansion would threaten fragile ecosystems in Rhode Island, and it would install high-pressure technologies that could increase the threat of an explosion. There's been little public comment so far, and the Green Party is seeking to educate the public and encourage them to take action. Further details are at sape2016.org. SAPE stands for Stop the Algonquin Pipeline Expansion. To list your group's local, regional, or national events, send announcements 1 week in advance when possible to the White Rose Political Calendar at valrichardson@wpcan.org. That's valrichardson@wpcan.org. This week's calendar was produced by Valerie and Rod Richardson.
And you can hear the White Rose Calendar every Monday at around 8 o'clock here on listener-sponsored WPKN Bridgeport. Please stay tuned for Counterpoint, which will be coming up right now.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. And Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Churn world serves its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Feed it up an ox, speak, grunt, no strength. The ladder starts to clatter with.
Good evening and welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, here Monday evenings between 8 and 10 p.m. Glad you could join us this evening. A lot going on in the world, and we have a lot to bring you in terms of news and analysis and commentary on all those happenings. We've got a discussion coming up front with author Peter Van Buren about the situation in Iraq with the Sunni insurgents of ISIS really trampling over the northern and central part of Iraq. We're going to get his take on what's going on in there and the appropriate response from the U.S. and the international community. A little later on, Rachel Tabachnik will be here from the Boston-based social justice think tank, Political Research Associates, and we're going to be talking about armed right-wing activists in the context of the danger posed by extremist anti-government groups and the support they receive from both conservative politicians, right-wing radio talk show hosts, and of course, Fox News. Still later tonight, Jim Dean will be here. He's chair of the group Democracy for America. And we're going to be talking about the significance of GOP Majority Leader Eric Cantor's defeat at the hands of Tea Party candidate Dave Brat in a primary, congressional primary, that took place in Virginia last week. So that's all coming up this evening. And very happy to welcome our first guest to the program tonight, and that's Peter Van Buren, a 24-year veteran of the U.S. State Department who spent a year in Iraq during the war there. When he published a book about his experience in the war titled We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People, the State Department launched legal proceedings against him. Peter's most recent book is titled Ghosts of Tom Joad, A Story of the 99%. Peter, it's great to have you on the program tonight. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure to be with you, Scott. Thank you.
Before we get to the situation in Iraq today, just tell our listeners a little bit about your experience in Iraq and why the State Department took legal action against you after your book was published.
I had worked for the State Department for 20-some years when, in 2009, I was sent to Iraq to run two provincial reconstruction teams. This was the vehicle by which the United States was going to win the war. These teams were designed to rebuild Iraq, reconstruct Iraq, to promote democracy, and all the things that go under hearts and minds. And it was my job to see that through for a year in Iraq. Instead of seeing any progress toward those things, what I realized is that there was no hope of us accomplishing our goals. Our own ineptitude and desire for pretty pictures and happy stories was clearly a huge part of it, But more significantly, it was obvious to me that the root problems that had been revealed when the United States kicked over the anthill in 2003, toppled Saddam, were never being addressed. In fact, they were being papered over in hopes that a nice exit could take place. I tried to go through channels, which is a popular thing for politician success, suggest whistleblowers do these days. No one at the State Department would talk to me. No one at the embassy in Baghdad would talk to me. My own boss chose not to talk to me. I tried to reach the inspectors general at the State Department and the military. They were friendly and sympathetic, but uninterested. Members of Congress had no interest in speaking with me. And so I decided to write a book. And that book was called We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. And even though it had been approved at some point and some level, Lord knows who lost their job over this, by the Department of State, State Department didn't realize what they had approved until the book actually came out. Once they realized that their ineptitude and failures in Iraq were now in print, they set out to do what is fairly typical with whistleblowers these days, and that is to strike against the messenger. We see this with Edward Snowden and others going all the way back to Daniel Ellsberg in the Pentagon Papers. The State Department first tried to claim there was classified material in the book, which wasn't true. They then tried to prosecute me for allegedly revealing classified information on my blog because I linked to a WikiLeaks cable. That fell through, as it obviously should have. They then failed to find a trumped-up excuse to fire me right away, so they basically sent me home for almost a year and said, we can't figure out how to fire you, and we can't figure out how to not pay you for a while, so go home and just stay out of here. Along the way, they put me on the Hillary Clinton security watch list and the Secret Service watch list, claiming that I was potentially a threat. I couldn't go to within 100 yards of the White House somehow. I also was banned from all State Department facilities. The diplomatic security was quite overt in explaining they would be monitoring all of my communications. This all went on and on and on until finally they created an excuse to fire me. Ironically, the excuse was that I had not cooperated fully in their investigations of me, which reminded me something of the Fifth Amendment right to not self-incriminate. But nonetheless, this started, and it was at that point I was very lucky to have attorneys from the Government Accountability Project and the American Civil Liberties Union step in, recognizing mine was a First Amendment case. With their help, I left the State Department on my own terms. And I'm currently working in New York City as a writer, and I've got a second book out called Ghosts of Tom Joad. A long introduction, but that's the background to what we're going to be talking about later today.
No, thank you for explaining that to the audience, and they'll know a bit about your experience and the decades you spent in the State Department and your exit, which is an important part of it. Peter, I wonder if you would provide an overview for our audience of the advance of the Sunni insurgent forces of ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq. What's your overview of what is now clearly a regional conflict between Sunni and Shia Muslims crossing the border of Iraq and Syria at this point?
What we're seeing in Iraq now and Syria, as well as other parts of the Mideast, is an inevitable response to the invasion of 2003. In 2003, the Middle East existed in a very uneasy but still working balance of power. Saddam in Iraq was a Sunni by name, but essentially a powerful secular leader who held together Iraq's three ethnic groups by force, using his secret police and the national security state to keep the minority Sunnis in power, the majority Shias in check, and the very powerful Kurds organized but not too organized, close but not too close. That had gone on for some years until the United States arrived and destroyed literally overnight civil society in Iraq, as well as disbanding the police, the army, the garbage collectors, the people who ran the telephone and the water systems, and everything else, right down to school teachers. That period of chaos in Iraq let loose the dragons that Saddam had kept in check, albeit through hard violence. Sunnis, Shias, and Kurds went for each other's throats. Over a period of almost 9 years of occupation, the United States failed to effectively deal with this. It was the gorilla in the room, if not the room that dominated the gorilla. It was everything that was going on in Iraq. Every roadside bomb, every soldier that was killed, every setback was because of this inherent tension and inherent conflict that we had unleashed and failed to succeed in putting back into the bottle, if you will. That is why we're seeing what we're seeing today in Iraq.
Peter, if you would go on to tell our audience, what is your view of the calls now, especially from certain sectors of the Republican Party? John McCain, Lindsey Graham, those senators are calling out Barack Obama for not stepping up to take military action that they believe is necessary to address this crisis in Iraq. And Lindsey Graham and others talk about that if the U.S. does not act, that Iraq will become the staging ground for the next 9/11 terrorist attack. What do you make of these calls for military action?
Well, not to start off tritely, but of course, Lindsey Graham and John McCain call for airstrikes every time someone sneezes in the Middle East. And so this is nothing new, but the same posturing and pseudo-macho rambling that we see from there. The short answer is that if the full force of the United States, $2 trillion in expenditures, the entire U.S. Army, and 9 years failed to solve the problems in Iraq, it is highly unlikely that some form of airstrikes or drone strikes or special forces can really do anything particularly significant. That's the short answer, and that's enough to say airstrikes would be foolish and, in fact, probably cause more harm than good. Airstrikes kill people, and as we've seen with our drone wars throughout the Middle East, it's very, very hard to only kill the quote-unquote right people. You end up blowing up wedding parties, mistakenly killing children, and all the rest. None of that will help the situation in Iraq, and none of that will help America's broader image and foreign policy goals. When you dig down a little bit, which is something that Washington has proven incapable of over an extended period of time in Iraq, you start to understand that airstrikes or any kind of military intervention is simply a continuation of the mistakes that we have been making continuously since 2006, primarily supporting one side in a triangular conflict, Sunni, Shia, Kurd. The United States helped install Prime Minister Maliki, the guy who runs Iraq, thinks he runs Iraq right now, in 2006 under very shaky circumstances. In the elections of 2010, which I was present for and worked on as part of the U.S. Department of State, Maliki did not win the elections, but the United States stepped back and allowed the Iranians to broker a compromise solution that put Maliki in power. Prime Minister Maliki almost immediately began punishing the Sunnis around him and, to the best of his ability, ignoring the Kurds north of him. And the United States, for the 4 years since the troops left, has been supporting Prime Minister Maliki in these actions. Continued support of him by airstrikes, if you will do nothing more but dig the hole deeper. The first rule of hole digging is, when you're in too deep, stop digging.
Well said. We're speaking with Peter Van Buren, a 24-year veteran of the U.S. State Department, who spent a year in Iraq during the war there and wrote a book about it titled We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. And, Peter, I wanted to ask you about partition. Not that long ago, Senator Joe Biden and others were talking about partitioning Iraq into three sections, one for the Kurds, a section for the Sunnis, and the southern part of the country for the Shia. Is this any kind of solution, or is there some kind of a priority to keeping the state of Iraq unified?
The state of Iraq should be written always in quotes, because it is an artificial construct that the British drew literally on maps following World War I. What we're seeing now is the process of the Middle East attempting to recreate itself along the proper regional, ethnic, religious, tribal, military, et cetera, borders. Your listeners who quickly realize that all those categories can be in conflict with one another, they get the A-plus for tonight's class. Breaking Iraq, or allowing Iraq to naturally separate into three states, was certainly a viable option in 2003, 4, 5-ish, somewhere in there, when the three groups would have likely been willing to accept a separation, and the United States Army could have enforced that by creating a buffer zone, basically putting itself in between the three conflicting forces long enough and forcefully enough to cause them to create natural boundaries that they could live with. I think that's what's going to happen in the long term in Iraq, whether we want it to happen or whether we help it happen or don't help it happen. The problem is that the separation that will occur now will be long, and it will be violent, and it will not favor the interests of the United States. Since 2003, the religious-based organizations, the media calls them jihadis, and I detest the term, but we'll throw that out there anyway. The rise of a more Islamic, more angry, if you will, religious driver has overtaken the politics of it. In 2003, you could have had a Sunni country, if you will, that would have reached a state of balance with its partners. Throw in what we call radical Islam now and all the outside forces that are at play. Everybody but Barack Obama acknowledges that the Saudis are funding much of the ISS activity in Syria and in Iraq, as well as Kuwait. Everybody but Washington understands that the Iranians are fighting a proxy war in the Middle East behind the Shias in Iraq and Syria. It's too much right now, in my opinion, to have it break into three states in any kind of peaceful way. Anything the United States continues to do in Iraq may postpone the inevitable, but it can't stop it.
All right. Well, Peter, we're just about out of time. I just want to thank you for taking time to talk with us. We'll like to have you back here again to talk about some of these complex issues you know well firsthand. And, you know, it's quite a mixed-up world where you've got the United States on two sides of the same battle between Sunni and Shia, the United States on the side of Sunni insurgents in Syria, and on the opposite side, aligned with, de facto aligned with Iran in Iraq. So there's a lot of complexities here that are hard to address in such a short interview. That's why we'd like to have you back.
My pleasure. I'd be happy to come back. This is four-dimensional chess, and the Iranians are playing it well. Other people are playing it well. America still thinks it's playing checkers, and will suffer accordingly. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Peter. Good night.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That's Peter Van Buren, 24-year veteran of the U.S. State Department and author of the book We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. And right now I'm very happy to welcome to the microphone my friend and colleague here at WPKN, Jim Motovalli. And interesting interview we just had on a very current and important topic, and I'm glad we had time to give it the time it deserved. But we do have to take some time right now to ask you for your contributions to this listener-sponsored radio station, and we're going to give the phone number out and hopefully get some response, if for nothing else, than the information you just heard from a perspective I think that's fairly reliable in terms of the context in which this individual, Peter Van Buren, worked for 24 years for the State Department. Our phone number here is 203-384-9756, 203-384-9756. I hope you'll phone in a pledge of whatever amount you can afford. We have some great thank you gifts, including below retail price tickets to the summer festivals, that include Falcon Ridge and the Vibes Festival.
I was going to go through some of those that do have available.
And the Green River Festival, I think, is the third one. But
Jim, the Green River Festival is a really great event. I've been to
the last
three of them.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
It's a great thing. It's in Greenfield, Massachusetts this
Not
year.
Far.
It's July 12th. Yeah, it's about, from Bridgeport, it's probably about 2 hours or a little less. And it's July 12th and 13th. You can get a one-day ticket for a pledge of $40, $30 for a Sunday ticket, or $70 for the weekend. And you can see great acts like Josh Ritter, Trombone Shorty, Puss in Boots. I really like to see them. It features Nora Jones, Sasha Dobson, and Catherine Popper. The Dirty Dozen Brass Band, Trembled by Turtles, Hooray for the Riff Raff, which is a very up-and-coming act. Dave and Phil Alvin and the Guilty Ones, The Lone Bellow, James Hunter Six, who are a really great R&B act if you haven't seen them. All kinds of different people. Grant Lee Phillips, Heather Maloney. A lot of the acts are sort of associated with the Signature Sounds label. So again, we have tickets to the Green River Festival in Massachusetts, and that's July 12th and 13th coming right up. Pledge of $70 will get you the whole weekend. We also have Gathering of the Vibes, which is held not more than a stone's throw from the WPKN studios.
Literally.
Literally. You could probably throw a rock. And it's in Seaside Park here. It's August 1st to 3rd. And it's become a very big deal on the festival circuit. You can get a three-day pass for $170. You can get a Friday ticket for $65, a Saturday ticket for $65. And you save money with these tickets, by the way.
Yeah.
And you see all these groups like Annie and the Hedonists. I don't know who they are. Effie O'Donovan, who I think walks on water. The Boxcar Lilies, Brother Sun, the Clayfoot Strutters, Cheryl Wheeler. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Falcon Ridge. I was thinking it was sounding very folksy for Gathering of the Vibes.
And it was.
It was.
Well, Falcon Ridge is another
great
festival.
Well, just say that everyone at Gathering of the Vibes is a Grateful Dead clone band.
No, they're not. No, they have some great
They're jam band.
Stuff.
A lot of them are jam bands, and I don't mean that any disrespect.
Well, who's the headliners? Do you have a listing there, headliners
there
for Vibes?
For some reason, they're not
year?
Listed here.
All right. Well,
I know
to,
the Grateful Dead aren't playing.
Well, members of the Grateful Dead always play that festival, so I'm sure...
Members do, yeah.
Yes. Well,
but the Grateful Dead, as we know it, no longer exists. Right. So the acts I was talking about are actually playing Falcon Ridge, which is actually the same weekend. So you have to choose between Falcon Ridge and Gathering of the Vibes. At Falcon Ridge, we've got Effie O'Donovan and the Boxcar Lilies and Brother Sun and the Grand Slambovians and John Gorka and Narissa and Catherine Niels. Roosevelt Dime is a real good group from around here. Spoyt and Dival, Tom Paxton, Tracy Grammer, all kinds of people. We have a three-day camping pass for $125 pledge, and that's in Hillsdale, New York, up where Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New York all come together. We have tickets to the International Festival of Arts and Ideas, and there's all sorts of people playing there, including Regina Carter. We have $50 a pair of tickets. Now, a lot of the events there are free, but we have tickets to some of the special ticketed events, including the Gloaming. You definitely want to see them. That is what you might call a Irish-American supergroup featuring Martin Hayes, violin, fiddle, and Dennis Cahill on guitar. That's on Thursday, June 19th. That's like next week, or is it this week?
June 19th. Today's the 16th, so it's,
so it's this
week.
Yeah, you can see the Gloaming this week. And also this week, in fact, tomorrow, what is tonight? Today's Monday, so it's tomorrow night, Tuesday, June 17th, Regina Carter, and we have $50 a pair tickets to those. We also have a benefit concert that I wanted to mention, and we need to get people down there for that. It's called Samba Lisa. And it's taking place at the Unitarian Church in Westport on Saturday, June 21st, so that would be next Saturday.
And that's a Brazilian band, in keeping with our theme this month of the World Cup down in Brazil. People can get tickets to Sambaliz at the Unitarian Church. That would be a great gig to go to.
Did Brazil win its game in the World Cup?
The first game.
I think it
did. First game, yeah. They did. And our number here to call for any of these thank you gifts in exchange for your contributions to this station, call us at 203-384-9756, 203-384-9756. Now, Jim is going to be standing by to get your phone calls, and we're going to proceed with some interviews that we've got lined up here tonight on lots of important topics. And I know many of you tune in each Monday to hear the interviews on current affairs, politics, economics, social issues, the things we usually discuss here. But I also know you attend summer festivals. But we do have some special premium thank you gifts for those of you who want to take advantage of something more related to the topics we cover here on Monday nights. And the first thing I want to let you know about is we have this great 600-page book titled The Untold History of the United States, co-written by Academy Award-winning director Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick, a historian we've had as a guest here on this show. And that's the book that accompanies this great multi-part documentary television series. I believe it was on Showtime last year. And that series really took an approach to U.S. history after World War II that is kind of like The World at War, if you've ever seen that series of black and white documentary films that repeated endlessly during the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But at any rate, this is a great documentary series from a perspective on history you're not likely to get many other places. Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick put together a great thing. And that's if you give us a $75 contribution or more, we'll send you the book. I've only got four copies here. The other thing is we've got highlights, a CD, double CD set of highlights from the Left Forum in New York City. And that features speeches by Angela Davis, Harry Belafonte, Cornel West, Chris Hedges, and many others. And that is a $50 contribution, and we send you that CD set as a thank you gift. And Jim, I'm going to transition to a little music here from John Fogerty. And I wanted, in fact, John Fogerty might be at the Vibes this year, if I'm not mistaken. I got to look that up. But
I'd like to see him.
He's great.
He's one of those enduring artists. He maintains his quality over the years.
But at any rate, I'm going to give the phone number out one more time. Jim is standing by to get your phone call. Support this station that brings you the information and the quality and diversity of music and culture and information that you get here regularly every day. Call us and pledge your support to keep us above the red ink, so to speak. We're trying to get rid of a deficit. That's one of the underlying reasons for our month-long drive in June. 203-384-9756. I'm going to turn up John Fogerty here and hope that you'll call. In fact, I'll rely on the fact.
203-384-9756. We need your calls.
I'll rely
just as we need John Fogerty in our lives.
You're going to call. Please call now, though. Don't wait. 203-384-9756.
Did you hear him talking about it on the radio? Did you try to read the writing on the wall? Did that voice inside you say, I've heard it all before? It's like deja vu all over. Day by day, I hear the voices rising, starting with a whisper like it did before. Day by day, we count the dead and dying, ship the bodies home. While the network's all keeps going, did you hear?
This is Counterpoint, and my name is Scott Harris. We're here every Monday between 8 and 10, and we bring you discussions of issues of the day from perspectives you're not ordinarily going to get in the corporate media. And we're very happy to welcome to our program right now Rachel Tabachnik. She's a fellow at the Boston-based social justice think tank, Political Research Associates, and she researches the impact of the religious right on policy and politics in education, economics, the environment, and foreign policy. Rachel, thank you for making time to be on the program tonight.
Thank you.
One of the things that prompted me to give you a call and to get your perspectives on what's going on with the right wing in this country was the tragic murder of two police officers and a shopper at Walmart at the hands of Gerard and Amanda Miller in Las Vegas just more than a week ago. The pair draped the flag adopted by the Tea Party, the Revolutionary War Gadsden Don't Tread on Me flag, over one of the slain officers they killed in a pizzeria, and also displayed a Nazi swastika at the crime scene. The couple talked before they were killed about their act of violence as the start of an anti-government revolution. And disturbing stuff, although I think a lot of our corporate media really isolates this incident as something, you know, as an outlier, something that is not at all connected to a larger issue or threat in the country. And I know you've done a lot of research on the organizations, militia groups and the like, who are around the country and advocate violence, anti-government violence. And we do see these incidents crop up every once in a while. But Rachel, maybe to start off here, I'd just get your overview on the significance of this particular incident that we saw in Las Vegas.
Well, of course, this very brutal violence was an outlier, but the sentiment behind it, the idea that that police are the threat and that government is the threat, and then there must be a revolution against particularly federal government, is becoming quite widespread. And in fact, we are seeing this kind of rhetoric in places, perhaps that we've not seen it before. We had a wave of this in the 1990s during the Clinton administration, and of course, the very well-known incidents at Ruby Ridge and at Waco that ended up resulting in a lot of anti-government rhetoric and violence. But what we're seeing today is interesting in that the rhetoric has spread through much of the religious right, through Tea Party, through the Tea Party activity, and also into county governments, including county sheriffs. One of the things that was curious about or tragic about this brutal killing, as we also found out that this couple had participated in the Clive and Bundy Ranch event in April, where Bundy and various militia groups and Oath Keepers had a standoff with the Bureau of Land Management in Nevada. And one of the groups that was involved there, in addition to Oath Keepers, is something called the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association. So one of the things that we see happening is where there were very few law enforcement involved, say, in the 1990s participation with militia groups. Today we are seeing this expand to rather substantial groups of sheriffs getting involved in this anti-government rhetoric and organizing.
What kind of threat do you think this represents to the country, Rachel? And how do you think, what is the best way for the government or people at large to respond to these folks who are walking around with guns, threatening law enforcement officers, and generally trying to intimidate people who are elected officials and otherwise represent elected government?
Well, I think it needs to be taken very seriously by the public. And when there are incidents of extreme violence, like this killing that took place by this couple, it should not be dismissed as just crazy or insanity. We need to be taking seriously this rise in anti-government sentiment, many of the conspiracy theories. You may recall several years ago there was a murder by Richard Poplawski of three police officers in Pittsburgh, which was another very tragic example of belief in conspiracy theories that the government is coming to get you, coming to get your guns, coming to put you in a FEMA concentration camp, these type of conspiracy theories. And again, this is something that's becoming quite widespread and not terribly uncommon, and not just among groups of militias and camouflage, you know, training in the woods somewhere, but becoming more part of everyday American life.
And we're speaking with Rachel Tabachnik, a fellow at the Boston-based social justice think tank, Political Research Associates. And we're talking about the recent incident of violence in Las Vegas at the hands of Gerard and Amanda Miller, who killed two police officers and a shopper at Walmart there, in what they said was the start of a revolution. Rachel, in your mind, what is the responsibility of some conservative politicians that we see at the state and federal level who articulate support for these anti-government groups, even those who are armed and threaten law enforcement officials with violence?
Well, I think these politicians do bear some responsibility in the escalation of the rhetoric. If you look, for example, when the Bundy standoff was going on, there were quite a few politicians who spoke very approvingly of Bundy and what he was doing. So I think these politicians do bear responsibility. We also saw a great deal of press and punditry in support of Bundy and what he was doing, right up until the point where he began making extreme racist comments. Then many of those politicians backed away. So there is a need to look more deeply at what is driving the narratives that are driving anti-government violence, and to take but be more responsible in response to those. For example, if you look at the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers organization that was there, and the Oath Keepers who were participating in the Bundy event, they claim to have signed up something like 484 county sheriffs around the country, with their main theme being resisting federal gun laws. This is a continuation of the sheriff's first ideology that we saw with some of the militias and posse comitatus in the 1990s, in which it is believed that the sheriff is the supreme law of the land, and that federal government has no right, federal agencies have no rights inside their counties without their permission, and that they can essentially resist federal law and regulatory agencies, including things like the Bureau of Land Management, FDA, EPA, and so forth.
And Rachel, I wanted to get your response to something that occurred in 2009, and that was the Department of Homeland Security, when they issued a report on the threat of right-wing extremism across the country linked to the economic downturn. And there was a very negative response among many conservative politicians in Washington who basically pressured the Obama administration to revoke this this report and its recommendations. And this report, quite interestingly sort of presaged a lot of these incidents that we've seen occur in the intervening years. You want to mention what you think is the importance of this report and the reaction to it?
Well, it was a short report titled Right-Wing Extremism, Current Economic and Political Climate Fueling Resurgence and Radicalization and Recruitment. And so the report was just looking at some of the factors that might be reviving the type of 1990s anti-government, militia, and violent activities of that era. And I think the report was probably very accurate in looking at some of the factors that could go into that, including the economic downturn, the election of our first black president, the hardships of the economic downturn, disillusionment of some veterans returning from the war. And so I think there were accurate assessments there that these things could contribute to a rise in some of the anti-government extremism and violence like we had seen in the 1990s. But there was a huge outcry, again, from politicians, conservative politicians, conservative press, that this was some kind of liberal plot against conservatives, that the Obama administration was targeting all veterans and all anti-abortion activists and all Second Amendment rights activists and so forth. And according to one of the people involved in the report, DHS did back off the report, and after that only had one person on this type of monitoring this type of domestic terrorism. Again, this is something that I think we need to take very seriously as we see the escalation of this kind of rhetoric and violence, and to look at the narratives behind it. I think across the political spectrum, of course, there's unhappiness with left and right, with military overreach, with NSA spying and so forth. But it's important to look at the extent of these narratives and the conspiracy theories that are becoming rampant out there, and to look at what could come from this.
Okay. Well, Rachel, before we say goodnight, I would like to have you give to our listeners the web address for your organization, Political Research Associates, and the kind of information they can find there.
Yes, that's politicalresearch.org. And this is a social justice think tank, but we have historically done a lot of monitoring of both the religious right and of extreme right organizations.
Right. And I know the Southern Poverty Law Center does some similar work as well, tracking the extreme right around the country. But Rachel, thank you so much for making time for us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
That's Rachel Tabachnik, a fellow at the Boston-based Political Research Associates. And this is WPKN in Bridgeport. My name is Scott Harris, and we're here with Counterpoint every Monday evening, bringing you a discussion of important issues of the day. And that one in particular really strikes a nerve in terms of the violence that we've seen escalating and the threats of armed insurrection among some right-wing elements in the country. It is frightening stuff. And to get some deeper analysis, we're glad that Rachel could join us. But we're taking time out of our program tonight to ask you for your contributions so that we can have this avenue of free expression on the airwaves, on Counterpoint, and the dozens of other programs that you hear here every day, every week, every month. WPKN is only possible because of your financial support. And this month, especially, we're trying to make up a deficit, which means we need all hands on deck. We need everyone to step up and pledge a little bit, a little more, or a lot, whatever you can afford. We've got some great thank you gifts for your contributions as an extra added incentive. But we like to think the incentive to call is not just the gifts, but really what you turn to this station to and for every day. 203-384-9756. That's the phone number to call, 203-384-9756. Again, we've got wonderful thank you gifts, and we'll talk about some of those details, but you can always call and find out what we've got in terms of the summer festival tickets, the books, the CD sets, the many artists box sets that we've got as thank you gifts as well. 203-384-9756. And I'm happy to say I'm joined this evening by my friend and colleague Jim Motivalli, who's has got his finger on the pulse of tonight's tally numbers. What are those numbers, Jim?
Well, my finger would have to be on the pulse for me to be able to tell you that. Oh, actually, yeah. Okay, well, we haven't taken in any money tonight. Our tally people have been sitting. Poor Mark has been sitting here completely bereft of phone calls. So we have $240 to bring in. So far in the pledge drive, we've taken in $23,000. $23.73.88.
Okay.
So a little over 23,000. We went over that today. And we have to go $16,926.12, which also amounts to 223 pledges. So we really need to hear from you tonight. We need you to be the virginal caller for Scott's show, 203. 384-9756. One thing let me mention that we're doing, we've done a pair of wine drawings thanks to Fountainhead and Fat Cat Pie Company in Norwalk. They've donated this excellent wine. Steve DiCostanza has been doing a show with them, and they play punk music and talk about wine. Somehow,
it's a good combination,
those things really go together. But we're having our third drawing. It's going to be June 22nd, Sunday night. And we've got a six-pack of aromatic, crisp, and refreshing summer white wines, unique grape varietals, not the usual suspects. And I would murder the names of these wines, but we have wine from Austria, from Italy, southern Italy, the Galician coast of Spain, the Greek island of Santorini, and Spain's Basque region. It's a $115 value, retail value. And if you are a pledger, you can be put in position for these drawings on Sunday night.
So any pledger, regardless of the amount they get, entered into the contest?
I believe that's how it works.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
In fact, I think you don't even have to be a pledger, but we prefer that you are.
203-384-9756. Let me mention again, we have this Samba Lisa coming up. We have a bunch of, we always have WPKN benefit concerts in the works because we never are able to rest in terms of keeping the station humming and bringing in money and ensuring that the station stays on the air. So we have the Samba Lisa event at the Unitarian Church, and it's on Saturday, June 21st, and 8 p.m. tickets are a pledge of $30 per ticket to WPKN, and that's Brazilian Samba and Jazz with some familiar jazz names from around Fairfield County. We also have the Grand Slambovians and Hamel on Trial. That's at the Fairfield Theater Company on Thursday, June 26th, 7:30, and tickets to that are a $35 pledge to WPKN. So please do give us a call, 203-384-9756. We have all these different events, and we have, as Scott mentioned, he has some specific premiums that are for his show, Highlights of the Left Forum. Thank you for that call.
Thanks for that call, really. It's
and
good to hear
also,
that phone ring.
Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick's The Untold History of the United States. And that's for a $75 pledge.
That's right.
And the CD is for a $50 pledge. So right. 203-384-9756. We've got some tickets. Oh, also, the Clearwater Festival, which is coming up.
Always a great
You know what I did? I'm such an idiot. I went all the way up there on Saturday thinking it was last weekend.
Wow.
Well, I did that. What an idiot.
It's a nice drive, though.
It is. It
it's
is.
Beautiful. Oh, okay. And the Hudson, it's beautiful.
I
right
dragged
on the Hudson
my
River.
Poor wife all the way up there.
It's
And you didn't check first?
It was always on Father's Day weekend. So it was Father's Day weekend. So I assumed. Well, anyway, it makes an ass out of you and me. But we have three pairs of tickets, and it's June 21st and 22nd at Croton Point Park.
And that's right on the Hudson River. What a beautiful location.
Yeah.
I've been there a few times. That's the festival Pete Seeger, actually.
This is the first year without Pete Seeger.
Yeah, sad to say.
And it's also the first year without Toshi Seeger, that both of them died.
Toshi died, too. Yeah, God.
So we have a great lineup. There's a real progressive lineup this year featuring Lucinda Williams, Rufus Wainwright, Puss in Boots featuring Nora Jones and Sasha Dobson, The Mavericks, Richard Thompson, Martin Sexton.
Richard Thompson?
Yeah,
Martin Sexton.
He's playing Saturday.
Great. Wonderful stuff.
Josh Ritter, Tom Paxton, Tom Chapin, and Rory Block.
Wow, that's a powerful lineup.
And we have $150 will get you a pair of tickets, which is worth quite a bit more than that. Yeah, it's not the cheapest festival to go to, so we have discount tickets to it.
Discount tickets. Now, you know, it's so interesting and advantageous for our listeners that you can get tickets that are below the retail price and still help WPKN out. I mean, why not take advantage of that? Why would you want to get tickets any other way? Really, there's no excuses. 203-384-9756.
Painless pledge, because you do something you were going to do anyway, which is go see the Clearwater Great Hudson River Revival.
But we have lots of other thank you gifts, including CD box sets of some of your favorite artists, and Jim. And Mark can tell you all about that. But do make that phone call. And last week, I think there was a Rangers game on, okay? So we gave you a little slack then.
Now we got the World Cup.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
Hey, did Iran manage to hold its own despite being 25,000-1?
Who's making these bets?
That was the odds against Iran, but they held their own against, I think it was against Nigeria.
Wow.
Well, and they're still in the they're in the running.
That's my preferred way to settle disputes, besides drones and bombs and guns. Let's have the people settle these disputes on the playing field. But 203-384-9756, give us a call.
Why don't you tell the Sunnis and the Shiites that's the better way to do it?
I agree. Let's tell them. We'll send a telegram. We'll send him an email tonight. 203-384-9756. Please make that call. As I was saying, last week there was a Rangers game on. So, hey, lots of excuses out there. But I guess I just want to emphasize that if you've ever listened to this show and appreciated any of the information that we get on the airwaves, the various guests that we get here that are usually not given a lot of time elsewhere or no time, please make that phone call and know that you're one of a very select few that listen to this station and are beneficiaries of the information, music, and culture that this station provides. And we really depend on each and every one of you to make a pledge sooner or later. And we hope sooner, because this fund drive will be over that much quicker and we can get back to our regular programming. So call us at 203-384-9756. You are listening. That's why we're talking and hopefully giving out that phone number with some results. But do make that phone call and understand there are a very special elite group of WPKN listeners we're depending on to step it up and make that call tonight. And you are one of them, my friend, in the words of Mitt Romney, my friend. 203-384-9756. Corporations are people, my friend. Isn't that his famous quote? Any rate, call us, please. Make that phone ring. We thank that one caller for checking in, but we do want to hear from many, many more this evening. We've got an interview with Jim Dean, Howard Dean's brother, who's chair of the group Democracy for America. We're going to get some response and reaction to the defeat of Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, and what that portends for U.S. politics. But we do need to hear from many of you tonight, more than just the one we've heard from so far. So make that call, 203-384-9756. And Jim, how can we cajole our friends out there, how can we cajole them to get on that phone right now?
Well, we have to probably acknowledge that for some listeners, there's kind of fundraising fatigue. We've been doing it for a while. You're getting tired of hearing it. Maybe that's your problem, but we are only about halfway towards our goal. Thank you for that call. 203-384-9756. That was a listener who stepping up, coming up to the microphone, and making his or her presence known. And despite fundraising fatigue, I know I'm talking to some listeners who have not pledged and have said they're going to get around to it. And, you know, the Rangers game was on, the World Cup was on, some sport event was on. You have some excuse. This is a real good time to pledge, especially if you're a regular listener to Scott's show. Obviously, a donation to PKN floats our whole boat, but it's not a bad time to call if you particularly like a show. This is a good time to actually call. So hopefully Scott's listeners will do the right thing. Step up to the phone, 203-384-9756. We have all those premium items that we've been talking about, and those enable pretty much a painless pledge, which means you can get these things at a discount for less, you know, one of these great summer festivals we've been talking about, the Green River Festival, the Festival of Arts and Ideas in New Haven. And a couple of those shows are coming up, like the Regina Carter show we were just mentioning, and the Vibes at the Seaside Park, just a little ways from us. So you can get those tickets at less than you would pay for them otherwise, and you will support WPKN in the process. So this is a real good time to give us a call and do that. Mark is talking to one loyal listener who stepped up. We need to hear from you. 203-384-9756.
And we have just one more rundown of these premium and thank you guests we're offering before we get to our next interview. But they include, as Jim just said, below retail price tickets to the Clearwater Festival, the Green River Festival in Massachusetts, the Festival of Arts and Ideas in New Haven, the Vibe Festivals here in Bridgeport, the Falcon Ridge Festival up in on the corner of Connecticut, New York, and Massachusetts, I believe, in that part of the state, and some great artists playing all those festivals. And the key thing is you can help PKN out at the same time you get below retail price tickets. It's a great deal for everyone. 203-384-9756. And in honor of all the years that Jim has put in here at this station.
Probably a few more years than you, Scott.
A few more years, but
not a lot more.
Collectively, a lot of years. And you know, stalwart here, providing incredible quality information and music, jazz, all range of things that Jim has put on over the years, including his discussions about the environment and car technology. Great stuff. And I'm so happy I got involved in a lot of ways.
Who was president when you started as a programmer at PKN? Because I think I go back to the Nixon era.
I go back to Grover Cleveland.
Grover.
203-384.
He was presidential timber in those days, huh?
In the ground, I think. But I've got to run to do our next interview with Jim Dean, so I'm going to play a little music. But please call us at 203-384-9756.
Jim. Is this guy known as Jimmy Dean?
No.
He's the guy that did Big John or the sausage guy?
Different guy. This is Howard Dean's
brother. Not the sausage guy.
Not the sausage guy. All right. Well, let's take a musical break here.
Ku Klux Klan.
Ku Klux Klan.
Berubah sensasi. stop, I stop the Ku Klux Klan. Hopeless with us all in vain. The Ku Klux Klan, I said, but a holler and dump all. Now let me go now. To let me go is not their intention, no. They say,
music from Steel Pulse, a song called Ku Klux Klan. Following our discussion of extreme right-wing groups, armed militias, and the like across the country with Rachel Tabachnik of Political Research Associates. And right now we're going to move on to our next discussion. And I'm very happy to welcome to our program Jim Dean, chairperson of the group Democracy for America. And we've invited Jim to talk about the surprising defeat of Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader for the Republicans, who lost to a Tea Party activist, David Brat, in his Virginia district last Tuesday. And Jim, thank you so much for making time to come on the program tonight.
Scott, appreciate your having me on. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, for our listeners who may not have the full picture of your group, I know most of our listeners have heard of it, but Democracy for America, tell us a little bit about its origins through your brother Howard Dean, who ran for president a bunch of years ago, and where the organization is at now.
Okay, yeah, Howard started Democracy for America after his campaign ended back in 2004, and he wanted to really support candidates running anywhere around the country at all levels of office, and he then went on to become chair of the Democratic National Committee, but we pressed on, and we are now with a membership of about 1.2 million people. And our job is really to help with training and staff help, help our members do what they want to do, can do, to change their communities. And a lot of that work is electoral, supporting candidates, but a lot of it is also working on issues such as minimum wage bills that are going on in one place or another in about 30 states, or this year particularly, other issues related to economic inequality. But really what we are is a staff of network administrators trying to help a lot of really good people working hard to change their communities.
Well, Jim, as I said a moment ago, we invite you to get a little bit of comment and analysis of what happened to House Majority Leader Eric Cantor last week when he was defeated by a Tea Party activist, David Brat, in his Virginia district. It was kind of a minor earthquake in Washington, D.C., and a lot of people are reading the tea leaves, so to speak. And I wonder if we get your take, your overview of you know, what is the significance of Eric Cantor's loss in this primary?
Well, I think there's several factors in it, and it's very difficult for me to weigh one over the other. But the first that comes to mind is that Eric Cantor was really a visitor to his district, somebody who actually really spent much more time in Washington than he spent in his district serving his constituents. And I think a lot of folks were upset about it. He had become very distant. As one columnist said, he had been spending more time campaigning to be Speaker of the House than he was for running for re-election. And I think that distance affected the vote, much the way that distance affected the vote against Joe Lieberman in Ned LeBlanc's primary victory over him back in 2006. So that was one thing. The second thing is I think there's a general dissatisfaction of the electorate overall with Republicans because they simply have refused to govern since Barack Obama became president. I mean, they've basically been the party of no. They really haven't offered any solutions to anything. And these primaries often turn into sort of a contest to see who can outright wing the other. Certainly David Brat was all of that. But I'm not even so sure that the issues, particularly immigration and some of the other things that David Brat talked about, how significant they were. Simply because I think of the dissatisfaction and the distance that they had between the incumbent was really the part that voters were really addressing when they went to the polls. These are low turnout elections, and And that can get people who are upset out to the polls, and they can win under those circumstances. But the good news is that it's an open seat now, really, for all intents and purposes. There is a Democrat in the race. That's important because over 65 seats in the House are actually uncontested this year. So at least we have a nominee. We don't know very much about him, but we'll see. It may mean a little bit of a change in the congressional makeup, and that's an opportunity for a lot of people.
Jim, what do you make of the analysis that says this particular contest is really it's really a harbinger of things to come for the Republican Party as the GOP moves ever further to the right and out of step with the rest of the country, where a majority of the people in the nation really disagree with the Republicans on a whole slew of issues? Is this, you think, does this portend a future where the Republican Party is ever more marginalized from the mainstream of American voters?
Oh, I would certainly agree with that. Certainly the platform of issues that Brett purports to support really put him out of the mainstream, even within his own district, which is an R plus 10, meaning a heavily Republican district. The whole sort of conservative takeover back, you know, or meme that's been going on within the party really has brought it to the brink of irrelevancy with respect to the rank and file voters around the country. I mean, and that's, you don't have to take my word for it. It's not so much as in this district as in a lot of other places. I mean, even in Kansas right now, there's a very competitive race for governor between a Democrat and a Republican right now. There's a very competitive race for governor in Georgia. Between a Democrat and Republican, and I think these are very conservative states where the Republicans have just simply gone too far, and not only far in their extremism, but also in not offering any meaningful and realistic solutions to the problems that we all have.
Your brother, Howard Dean, recently wrote an article for Politico, former governor of Vermont, Howard Dean, former presidential candidate, former DNC chairman. Jim, he wrote that one of the lessons we can learn here is that through this insurgent candidacy of David Bratt, that big money doesn't always win elections. And, you know, we've seen that in other places around the country from time to time. Doesn't happen all that often. But what do you think we can learn from the grassroots campaign this Tea Party activist ran and the lessons for progressive candidates who may not have as much money as other folks in a particular contest?
Well, we have seen this before many times where progressive candidates win without a financial or at a significant financial disadvantage around the country. I mean, we can talk about Jerry McNerney's race against Richard Pombo back in 2006, and we could go on and on and on through one race after another. The fact is that when it comes to progressives or Democrats, we've always been outraised. And the best way to win really is having meaningful conversations with voters and motivating them to get to the polls. And that does win elections. That's not to say that we shouldn't overturn Citizens United, because we should, and we should get that money out of politics. And that's probably one thing that both Democrats or conservatives and or liberals and Republicans all share. They want to see money out of politics. But you could definitely win races. I mean, there's some great candidates this year that are doing it that way. I want to actually point out to Shenna Bellows running against Susan Collins for U.S. Senate in Maine, running a fantastic campaign. Again, that is going to be a field effort where they engage the voters instead of just throwing television commercials at them that most voters don't really even want to watch or aren't even really paying attention to anyway.
We're speaking tonight here on Counterpoint on WPKN in Bridgeport with Jim Dean, chairperson of the group Democracy for America. We're doing a postmortem of the loss of House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, who lost to a Tea Party activist, David Bratt, in the primary for his Republican district last week. And Jim, one of the interesting things is that although the Tea Party and progressive activists have very little in common in terms of issues, it seems that this Tea Party candidate in the Virginia district who beat Eric Cantor ran on a platform of anti-Wall Street advertising. He basically castigated Eric Cantor for his ties to these big Wall Street firms and all the perks they get from their cozy relationship with Congress. And although there isn't much in common with progressive activists, it seems that the left and right might overlap a little bit when it comes to pointing out the hypocrisy of Congress, not looking out for the little guy, for the average citizen, but, you know, in these very lucrative deals with Wall Street brokers who, you know, get a lot of custom-made policy there in the halls of Congress in Washington.
I would absolutely agree that there is overlap there. I think a lot of Americans in this country, again, I wouldn't just say progressives and Tea Party folks. I would say it is very mainstream right now among Americans that they are really fed up with the strong ties between Congress and big business. And also Americans are fed up with big business itself, which talks free enterprise out of one side of its mouth. And is constantly pining for taxpayer subsidies and tax breaks and offshoring their profits and not really being responsible at all. So I think there's a very, very big strain of this going on. I think it's displayed in the fact that an overwhelming number of Americans across the board support minimum wage increases, support increasing Social Security benefits instead of cutting it back, are not happy about this whole Wall Street engineer plan to start taking away and dumbing down pensions that are due to particularly government employees, many of whom have foregone Social Security benefits to be in those pension plans. And I want to point out another candidate for U.S. Senate, pundits would say is a long shot, Rick Wyland running in South Dakota, very conservative state. He has traction in his campaign because he is absolutely addressing this kind of issue, particularly the issues with big business. His campaign theme is Take It Back, and he is going door to door and town to town, and that is a message that is playing very, very well with the voters in South Dakota, and if it can play well there, I guarantee you it's playing well in a lot of other parts of the country right now, including centers of banking and big industry.
Jim, I wanted to ask you if you think the results of this primary in Virginia that saw the defeat of Eric Cantor, the GOP House Majority Leader. Does that send you any messages about what might be possible in terms of the results of the 2014 midterm elections this November?
Well, it certainly sends the message that I've been thinking about and frankly have been a little bit concerned about for some time. This is about voter turnout. This is about voter engagement. And I would say this to anybody, that it is incredibly important that we cast our vote in November 2014. These races, and I'm not just talking about the congressional races, but city council, state legislature, even these local races have just as much to do with our quality of life as those races up the ticket. And it is absolutely critical that we get out there and vote. And frankly, this is a way really for us to finally rid ourselves of this kind of right-wing extremism, particularly the lack of governance among Republicans, and really show who's boss. I think we can send a really important message this year, but we just got to go out and cast our ballots. And I think one thing that Brat did prove is that if you can get your folks out, you can win. And he got his folks out, and you know, I'm hoping that Trammell, who is the Democratic candidate in there, will be successful because right now, as I said before, this is an open seat and it may be in a Republican district. But again, that's not that gerrymandered as people think. And if we get our folks out, we can have a Democrat actually representing that district.
Yeah, gerrymandered districts are a big issue in the way the country is governed these days. And I guess I'll have to wait till the next census in 2020 in order to revisit the districts and how they're drawn up around the country. But, Jim, I just had a last question for you here, and that centers on there are many progressive activists around the country who are trying to encourage independent U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders to run for president in 2016. And I guess if he decides to run, he'll have to make the decision whether to choose to run as a Democrat in Democratic primaries, presumably against former Secretary of State and U.S. Senator Hillary Clinton, or to run as an independent, much like Ralph Nader did a bunch of times over the last two decades. Maybe you can give us your two cents. What do you think about Bernie Sanders as a presidential candidate?
Well, first of all, I would be delighted if he ran because he is going to push, and as he has done for decades, The issues that are related to economic mobility and certainly economic inequality. He is the spokesperson for that. He's been terrific for so many years, and we really need to have that debate at the presidential level. And that is actually the reason that I'd like to see him run as a Democrat, because it would carry that message louder and further if he were able to do that, and it would also put him four square in the middle of the debates. And surfacing these issues and forcing other candidates in the race, no matter who they are, to answer to where they are in minimum wage, answer to where they are on increasing Social Security benefits, answer to doing something to make Medicare better than it is. And it actually is a pretty good system as we have it right now. Those are the things that Bernie is going to push for, and we really need to have that debate in the presidential election. And again, I think my sense is that if he ran for Democrat as a Democrat, his voice, his soapbox, if you will, would be a little bit bigger and better, and that would help everybody in this country.
All right. Well, Jim, we'll definitely revisit that issue in the near future. I'll have you back. But we're out of time right now in the midst of our fun drive here this June. But thanks for making time to come on the program, and leave our listeners with your web address, if you would.
Sure. It's democracyforamerica.com. And Scott, I really appreciate the work that all of you are doing. I'm a big fan of PKNs and really, really glad you're on the air and keep pushing it.
All right. Thank you, Jim. Appreciate your time tonight. Thanks. Good night.
Thanks, Scott.
Bye-bye. That's Jim Dean, chair of the group Democracy for America, brother of Howard Dean, and who started the group when he ran for president in 2004. It's 20 minutes after 9 o'clock. I'm here with Jim Motivalli and Mark Mushin, and we're asking for your contributions so that this station and the guests we bring you here each and every Monday night, the incredible diversity of music, culture, camaraderie that you get from real people behind these microphones, all that you listen to WPKN for is here indefinitely. But that only happens with your contributions and your support. We're an independent station that relies on independent contributions from you, our listeners. So please make a phone call to 203-384-9756, 203-384-9756. Jim, I've got Harry Belafonte waiting in the wings here. The Harry Belafonte.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
You're going to talk to him?
Yeah. Well, I've got a speech that he presented that I recorded. I was within 6 feet of him the other day. And he talked about social justice, which, you know, I think most of our listeners are aware, in addition to being a great singer, an actor, and a guy who's well known in, you know, Hollywood and entertainment worlds, he also is a social justice activist. And he told some great stories about the civil rights era and Martin Luther King and things that he was involved in freeing people who were in jail in Greenwood, South Carolina, all sorts of great stories. But we can only bring you that this evening if we get a requisite number of phone calls. And I'm going to ask you, Jim, to name that number of phone calls we need to hear Harry Belafonte.
How about a total of 5.
That's doable.
I would think.
Yeah.
Things are looking up a little bit back in the tally room here. We have taken in $330.
That's good news.
So if we get $90 more, we'll have fulfilled our. I think we should be able to do that. Come on.
Yeah. No. I'm gonna hold off here until we actually cross that threshold or the 5 calls, whatever comes first. I'm going to put the pressure on our listeners right now. People who want to hear Harry Belafonte about his social justice life, as opposed to his Hollywood and singing career. You want to hear about social justice from Harry Belafonte speaking at the Left Forum 2 weekends ago. Please call us at 203-384-9756. Give us a call. Make a pledge of any amount. And if you're just joining us, Jim and Mark can both fill you in on the great number of wonderful below retail price tickets, and I'll emphasize that phrase again, below retail price summer festival tickets for a slew of great summer music festivals from the Clearwater Revival on the Hudson River to the Green River Festival up in Massachusetts, the Festival of Arts and Ideas here in New Haven, the Vibes Festival here in Bridgeport, and the Falcon Ridge Festival on the border of Connecticut, New York. All those are great music venues. If you've ever been to any of them, you know they're just a beautiful time to camp, or you know, just go in for a day in these bucolic settings. Even in Seaside Park in Bridgeport, it is bucolic and a lot of great stuff.
Personal and